Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lorraine, can I ask you about steam room etiquette? Because I popped in there after my swim at the gym this morning for a little steamy moment. And of course, there was a man manspreading and doing very sort of laboured breathing. And I was like, realised that he was this guy who'd actually dived into the pool, because obviously you're not supposed to dive into the pool, made a big splash, and there he was manspreading and puffing and breathing. So I wasn't focusing on sitting down on the bench, and of course it's very wet and you get that really embarrassing squelch noise that might sound like something else beginning with an F, which happened to me. So I was very embarrassed.
Well, you're the woman that survived the something beginning with an F when you did a headstand in yoga, so you've got the skills for this.
It was a long time ago. I've spent 20 years trying to avoid it.
Personally, I'd take a towel in and smother him to death, but obviously that's militant, my raging feminist alter ego. You do a little cough, Trish, do a little cough, like that.
Oh, what, after you've done the squelchy noise?
After you've done it, yes, and then look down at your feet in that way.
And try to pretend that it didn't happen.
Try to pretend, yes. Or you just let rip, Trish, you just do the real thing.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
And I'm Trish Halpin.
If you're living in a hormonal hot house, feeling a bit overwhelmed and in need of some positive, uplifting and comforting guidance on how to lead a more magnificent midlife, then this is the show for you.
We chat to celebrities and experts on all things midlife, from menopause and perimenopause to parenting teens, via fashion, beauty, wellness, nutrition, fitness, careers, relationships, caring for elderly relatives and your finances.
Yes, we ask experts and famous guests all the questions you need answered to have a happier, healthier and more harmonious second act.
Right, we have popped on our uniforms, our tabards, we've pinned on our customer service badges, all metaphorically speaking, of course, because we are once again at the disposal of the fabulous midlife women of the UK and all over the world, in fact.
Yes, you and the word tabard, Trish, you squeeze it in wherever you can.
Well, I do.
We are on a mission, as you know, on this podcast, not only to put a smile on your faces with our waffling and a warm arm around your shoulders, but we're here to share info and intel on all things we unearth and discover in our working and domestic lives as journalists. All the information we think will be helpful for you, our lovely listeners. We need to come up with a little motto, don't we? Sort of a bit like never knowingly undersold. Every little helps because I'm worth it. Maybe because you're worth it. That's what we should say.
The only thing we've actually managed to come up with so far is knowledgeable nitwittery.
Yeah, we might have to hire someone, a big branding firm, to come up with a better thing than knowledgeable nitwittery.
Pay them a year's salary to do that for us. But yes. But we do love to know when we're getting it right. So thanks to all of you who email us or post on the Facebook group after you've heard an episode.
Yes, it is really nice to get this feedback. We had a really lovely message from Jo, who's all the way in Auckland, which is in New Zealand, Trish, should you want to know.
Well done.
And she says, I really enjoyed listening to the podcast episode with Nisha Katona. It was fab. As a total foodie and someone who loves to cook, many of the dishes mentioned really tickled my taste buds. I found and saved the Ottolenghi mushroom and lentil ragu recipe. Oh, I've got that, Trish. I'm going to try that. I'm going to make Nisha's suggested quick spiced cabbage dish tonight to go with some leftover curry. And I've managed to find the Ayurvedic apples recipe easily on Google. However, Trish was talking about this great low no sugar granola from The Guardian. But when I Googled it, I got many options dating from 2013 to 2020. So I'm not sure which one you're referring to. Well, our knowledgeable nitwittery service doesn't just stop at the podcast, but lovely little Trish took time out from one of her mini gym sessions lifting weights, and she posted the link for you, didn't she, Jo? You put that link in there, Trish, didn't you, for Jo, for her granola. So we are always happy to answer questions off air. Another little bit of advice for the listeners who mention on the Facebook group that they can't find all the programme notes with all the links and all the Googles and all the tags and all the things. And they're usually listening while they're walking, et cetera, et cetera. So I did reply and say, well, we don't actually have time to do really massively detailed program notes. It's just the two of us. And we're sort of relying on you to listen. But it just struck my mind, and I hope I'm not patronizing anyone here, but if you are listening on your phone while walking, just press pause, go to the notes section of your phone. Everyone's got it on their phones, and just write it there as you're walking. And then you'll have it stored. I don't know, maybe people aren't thinking of that, but we aren't going to be able to do detailed notes, but you can just take them yourselves as you're walking on notes. That's some tech advice from me, Trish.
Oh my God, very high tech. But our interview with Dr. Niget Aref a few weeks ago about UTIs had a big response too. And this one was one of my favourites from Lynn, who said on the group, Dr. Aref's chat on the podcast was invaluable to me whilst on holiday in Uruguay. I was getting fed up constantly needing the bathroom and decided to take her advice and give oestrogen pessaries a try. It was a challenge at the pharmacy. My Spanish for travellers didn't help very much. But with Google Translate and gestures, I mean, vaginal pessaries, gestures, that would be interesting. We got there in the end. The female pharmacist was lovely and we had a good laugh at our efforts to mime the instructions. Several days on and I'm improving no end. Thank you, Lorraine, Trish and Dr. Niget. I mean, how amazing is that? You've actually written a really good feature as well on Substack, our Substack mini magazine, going into a lot more detail on UTIs and your own personal experience too, which is another way that we like to be helpful, isn't it?
Yes, we do sort of open up our own personal stuff and overshare. I mean, I think that's probably the most I have ever overshared. It's on our Substack, Postcards from Lorraine and Trish. If you just go to Substack on the internet, type in Postcards from Lorraine and Trish, you will be able to read my experience of UTIs from the age of 13 and how what Dr. Niget said has completely changed my life. So that was absolutely brilliant to have her on the show. And I'm so glad we helped everyone. Now, as a lot of you might be listening to this on Mother's Day, I want to give a shout out to my little Trish as well, because you wrote a really moving piece about your mum on Substack and how you are feeling now that you're approaching the age she was diagnosed with breast cancer, your lovely late mum, and also what helped you in dealing with your grief and what you do still now to feel connected to your mum, because it's 20 years since she died, isn't it? And we had some really lovely comments on that one, didn't we?
We did, yeah, because there is this community element to Substack too. So it's as always, we just like getting feedback and response and your thoughts and ideas and sharing that. But obviously, Mother's Day, we'll all be experiencing Mother's Day in a different way. We've all got mums. Some are here, some are not. Some of us might be mums too. Hopefully lots of love. And maybe even the teenagers will have remembered to write a card. Do you think that's going to happen? Because we're just recording this a couple of days before Mother's Day. So mine haven't arrived yet from the university, but I haven't got very high hopes.
I don't hold out high hopes.
You know, I think I've said this before, we have a running joke in our family, because when those lovely little ones where they used to draw them at school or whatever, he always used to put from. He signed it off from.
Oh, just in case you didn't know.
No, like love, kiss, nothing like that. So to this day now, it's a bit of a running joke in our family. That's the level of affection that comes my way.
It's like the accidental Valentine card I got for James with the penguins on the front, which said to my friend inside. Oh. Because I didn't read the inside, I just saw the penguins, and obviously penguins is a thing we share.
Oh.
Anyway, our guest today fits with our service theme very nicely. She's best-selling author, professor, and former paediatric nurse, Christy Watson, who spent more than two decades working in the NHS. She'll be joining us shortly to talk about her new book, a thriller which is based on her experiences in the medical profession and her adorable one-day style midlife love story.
Yes, her true love story. That's going to be good. But Lorraine, you've gone above and beyond in your investigations and acts of service this week.
Oh, this is exciting.
You went off and got yourself hypnotised, which we're going to talk about later. I mean, you only did it yesterday, so I have no clue what, where or why on earth you did it. So I'm going to be keen to find out what you discovered, what happened.
Yes, I've learnt how to self-hypnotise, and I might be able to hypnotise that podcat, that nemesis, Margot. I might hypnotise her to go on a very long walk, Trish.
Near a cliff.
Just on and on and on. Forrest Gump of cats. We first met best-selling author, professor and former paediatric nurse Christy Watson almost 4 years ago, right at the beginning of our podcast journey. But we've invited her back today to talk about the seismic changes in her life after we interviewed her about her chart-topping non-fiction books, The Language of Kindness and The Courage to Care. Christy, 47, started her career at Great Ormond Street Hospital and worked across several disciplines for more than 20 years. She even continued nursing when her first novel, Tiny Sunbirds Far Away, won the prestigious Costa First Novel Prize in 2011, and she was back on the wards working during COVID. But Christy is no longer a medic and has committed to writing full-time. Her sixth book, Moral Injuries, a medical thriller, is out now. We'll be asking Christy how she made the decision to give up her beloved profession that defined her and what she has learnt from that, and also what she's learnt about the NHS today researching her book that may be helpful for you to know. And we'll also be finding out how Christy's books brought someone special back into her life. Prepare yourself for a moving love story on a par with One Day, except this one has a really happy ending. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife again, Christy.
Hello to both of you.
Shall we start where we left off last time? Your nursing memoirs were global bestsellers. Then you wrote Quilt on Fire about your midlife journey through perimenopause as a single mum. You've got two teenagers, 16 and 19. You were working as a nurse during COVID. So tell us how that all came about and what has happened since.
Wow, it's been eventful, I must say. It's quite strange and surreal. I think, like most people, I look back at that period of pandemic, it almost doesn't feel very real. But yes, I wrote Quilt on Fire following a very spectacular perimenopausal period where, like so many other women, I fell apart really in order to put myself back together again. It feels now like a necessary falling apart. But I was really, I suppose, trying to understand what was going on by the act of writing the memoir. And it was very cathartic. And felt much less alone when I started talking about it and realizing that every single other woman I knew the same age was feeling just about the same as I was. And yet I feel slightly on the other side of that hump now, which is thanks to HRT, therapy, writing, and frankly, just hanging on sometimes. So I feel psychologically in a much better place. And I'm also no longer a single parent, which I know we're going to get onto.
Yes.
But it's been very, very, very eventful few years. Some of it's been amazing. Some of it's been really traumatic. Like all of life, I've just had a lot going on. And then obviously I wrote Moral Injuries and returned to fiction, which has been a total joy as well.
And through all of this, obviously, you've had a major career change, haven't you? Because you've left nursing. We hear from a lot of women actually on our Facebook group at this life stage that working in healthcare is really quite hard and they need to move on, they need to look for something else. But did it affect your sense of identity no longer being a practicing nurse?
Yeah, it was quite a long time ago that I left clinical practice. It was after I published my first memoir and I've written three. So it was about 2018, I believe, I completely left nursing and then went back very shortly during this call to arms during the COVID pandemic. I've got very mixed views about it. I still very much feel like a nurse. I think it's like the mafia. You don't ever leave. I'll always be a nurse. It's just part of my DNA. And so I don't miss it in the sense that I just am it. Yeah, I kind of live, breathe and talk about it all the time. And now I'm professor of medical humanity. So I'm around a lot of medical students and doctors and healthcare practitioners, as well as nurses. So I kind of am still one foot in that world. But the thing that I missed the most was a long, long time ago. And it was the early days of nursing when I was a junior nurse and I was by the bedside with my patients and hopefully giving the care that I wanted to give. And the NHS back then was a very different place and much better resourced. And resourcing now, as we know, in the NHS is just disastrous. So I feel glad not to be there at the moment. And the idea of doing a night shift when you're going through the menopause, or nine night shifts and having no staff and no toilet breaks, I just can't imagine how difficult that must be for people.
And do you have any advice for any women who are not necessarily in the medical profession, but just making this massive, Trish and I have both done it, massive change of life, because we don't go into an office anymore. We don't have a team anymore. We don't see those people that we work with for 30 years. They suddenly weren't in our lives anymore. What did you learn about that? And what would be helpful to a woman just on the brink of that now?
I think it's always good to recognise that the grass is always greener, or maybe not. Because the idea that you create something new for yourself and perhaps it'll be less difficult is redundant. It's not the case. You move from one set of issues to another, particularly if you're moving to something freelance. It is very freeing. The word is in there. But you're also sometimes quite lonely. It's a delight for me to come on your podcast because you might be the only people I speak to until this evening, which is obviously, it's such a huge privilege to be a writer, and it's such a huge privilege to be freelance and do something creative and something different. But it's also really, really hard work. Really hard work, in a way, different hard work from nursing, but just as difficult, actually, because you're always trying to make ends meet. You're always worried where the next thing's coming from. So you end up taking on so, so much. So I just think, be prepared for the fact that all work is hard work. It has to be. But obviously, those days where, for example, my granddad worked in the same job his whole life, he retired at 60 and got a tanker. And is it tanker or tankard?
Tankard. I don't know. Trish says tabard every time she uses the T word. Yeah.
A mug, a metal mug. And then had a retirement party and he'd worked with the same people his whole life. Those days are gone. People change careers quite often, actually. And I think that's a beautiful thing, because we grow and we evolve and we're not the same people. And you still keep the layer of who you were and your colleagues and that friendship group that you had. You're just moving it to somewhere else. So I've got very mixed feelings, is the answer.
And talking of layering, of course, your fabulous new book, Moral Injuries, it's a novel. So your writing side mixed with your knowledge of the medical world. It's a thriller, which you've described as sex, lies and medicine. Tell us a little bit about the plot. Obviously, you can't give too much away.
Yeah, so I really wanted to get into that idea of women at work. And I really wanted to dig into colleagues. What is it like to have colleagues in such a high pressured environment, like I know you've worked in?
Well, we've never saved any lives, Christy, let's be honest here.
You saved my life. I'm sure you have more than you realize. But there is something very specific about women at work, and I wanted to present three women who happen to be doctors at the top of their game, which you really don't see very much in fiction, and their relationship. And I wanted to write this twisty, turny thriller and explore the dark heart of medicine, in that medicine doesn't have the answers most of the time, despite what people think. And doctors and nurses and other allied healthcare professionals are not heroes, and they're certainly not gods. They're flawed. And frankly, can I swear on this? Am I allowed to?
Yeah, yeah. She's got a right potty mouth.
they're a bit fucked up as the rest of us. And so I really wanted to get into that. For me, the most exciting part of medicine is not accident and emergency, where you're cracking chests and resuscitation. It's actually the morals and the ethics of who is making these decisions and why they're making them. So that's what it is. I'm hoping it will keep people up at night, really, a little bit disturbed.
Bit disturbed, yeah. And also because you have the other moral, friendship moral thing running alongside it. And at the end, you can't quite believe one of them has done what they did. It's quite inexplicable of a woman to do. So it's quite, and the parents, it's a bit about motherhood as well, and all those decisions. And I really enjoyed, I did have to stay up to finish it because I just thought, I just need to know. I think you mentioned it there. And I think one of the aspects to pick up on, because it's in the news quite a lot, and I'd be really interested in your opinion on it, is this idea of these very high profile consultants as kind of superhumans. They are almost godlike. That's kind of, it's extraordinary when you're in the, you can't possibly question a consultant who's been saving lives and, as you say, cracking open chests and holding hearts in her hand as she fixes them. That's something we might all face in midlife because we're in hospital a lot more. And I know recently, and I'm sure our readers have heard about it, Martha's Rule came into action, which is in 100 hospitals in the UK now, where parents can ask for a second opinion to review the care of one of their relatives. So that's they may not have confidence in the person treating them. They can ask for a review. And Merope, Martha's mum, who Trish and I know pretty well because she works at The Guardian, you know, has talked about feeling powerless in the face of these superhuman medics. What advice would you have then, having done the research for the book on the NHS Now and in your thing, how do we not feel so powerless when we're in those life and death situations, or just in those, you know, I don't want my mum to be fed today, she hasn't had any water, that kind of, how do we combat that? How do we deal with it?
I think it's a really good question. And perhaps there's this cultural shift that needs to happen and is happening, actually, because if the NHS is our national religion, then it's a godless one. And most vast majority, and I would say 99% of the clinicians I've ever worked with are safety critical, professional people who are doing their very best in a system that's being failed. And sometimes they get it wrong. But the vast majority of the time, I would say, are the most trustworthy people in the world. However, they're human. And so the idea that there's this huge amount of power in one person's hands, it's not helpful to the patients, but it's not helpful to the doctors either. And so I think most medics would welcome scrutiny, second opinions, a team effort. Medics welcome lots and lots of questions, actually. And it's quite interesting because when I worked as a nurse, I used to go into consultations with people who had really difficult conversations with their doctors, and the doctors would explain what was happening, sometimes really tricky information. And they would say, do you understand what I mean? Have you got any questions? And the family would say, no, no questions at all. And then the consultant would leave and they would turn around to me, the nurse, always inevitably, and say, what was it they just said? And so I think that's really unhelpful for the clinician, for the doctor who thinks that they've got the information across, but also for the patient and the family. What is, I suppose, a little bit worrying to me and to friends who are working in the NHS is there is a lot of rage that is being directed about the state of the NHS towards doctors and nurses on the front line. And that rage feels very misplaced. If we have this collective rage, then hopefully change can happen and we'll get greater resources that are so desperately needed. But it's not the doctor and the nurse on the ground who are in charge of that. It's the politicians. So it's quite an interesting cultural change. And it's quite unsettling, actually. But I think change does need to happen all round. And I think this new bill is a very, very good thing. And most medics would absolutely welcome it.
Do you want to tell us about the new bill? Because I think what we hear, what we see is like junior doctors on strike, operations being cancelled, all of this sort of thing. So it's, I mean, you know, obviously the media plays a part in that and making us feel a little bit frightened about the NHS. But what do you think is positive and good that's happening?
Ultimately, the NHS, I think, is still one of the best healthcare systems in the world. You know, now that 100 hospitals, I think it was that you said, I'm not quite sure, are being encouraged to ask for second opinions if you can't have them. I mean, that's always been the case, but it's actually in the media and people know about it, which empowers people because people don't often know that they can and they've got every right to get a second opinion. But I think much more than that, the very best clinicians in the world still, just about still, because I think Sky News reported recently that one in three junior doctors is planning to leave the UK. I mean, the statistics are quite terrifying, but some of the best people, I mean, I can't even tell you. I worked in a paediatric intensive care unit, and not infrequently, we would get children on the edge of life transferred from private hospitals to the NHS because that was the only way that they would have a hope at life if they were completely, completely sick. So, you know, we've got a place and an institution organisation where the very best doctors and nurses in the whole UK are working, but they're working under such enormous pressure and enormous stress that they are, which is the title of the book, they are developing moral injuries because they're not able to provide the safety critical care that they want to provide and that patients so desperately deserve.
I think it's really good to hear that you can ask questions as well, isn't it? I certainly know when my dad was in hospital with a heart, I think it was his fourth heart bypass or something. My mum was very much, don't bother the consultant when he comes around. She said to me, don't you ask him loads of questions. He's really busy. He hasn't got time to talk to you. And it's that kind of attitude that's changing. And I, you know, and to know that a consultant would probably welcome questions, I think would be super helpful. Now, one of the other things about writing the book is that you're studying this thing you just mentioned of people working together, colleagues. It's a real sense of belonging, isn't it, when you work in a kind of environment like that? What do you think you learnt about work environments that other listeners, maybe not working in NHS, but listeners could learn from, that groupings of people together? You must have had a few aha moments about how to make it work smoothly that you can pass on to listeners.
Yeah, I think we've all learned something, haven't we, in the last few years about the importance of community, of colleagues, of routine and structure that we were so lacking for a long time and actually haven't really returned to in any meaningful way really yet. We're still trying to understand what this new way of working looks like and how that affects our collective mental health. But I think that in the NHS particularly, because you are working in such extreme conditions with such extreme experiences that you can't talk about because of confidentiality outside work, it means that your relationships become really intense. And I've often sort of dug into what was it that made me go back during the pandemic or made me stay for so long in the NHS when things were really difficult. And the answer was colleagues. It was the colleagues who held you up at the most difficult times. And I think that's true of many professions, actually, is that the support you can have from a really good team is second to none in not only, I suppose, producing really good work, whatever your work is, but in your life. It's so, so important. And I do really miss that idea that we all have now where we're just sort of floating around, some of us, when we're working from home, and the office, the 9-to-5 Monday to Friday office model is no longer. And yet I think there's a loss actually for me. I feel a bit like maybe that will be a loss for all of us. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
Weird. I feel a bit weird. I mean, I love it because I'm totally in charge. And then I think, who can I talk to about this? And then I might chat to my husband. He's a bit rubbish about gossip. He doesn't know who Beyonce is or any of that kind of thing. So I'm sort of trapped at home without any interaction. And then sometimes Trish and I will have massive interaction. We'll see a lot of people, you know, and it'll be, I guess, for us, the learning curve has been to deal with change because every day is incredibly different. And I think that, you know, even people working in offices still, it's all very different now. Certainly my husband's only back 3 days a week, not 5 days. So for him, it's a different learning curve as well, isn't it?
Yes, it's change and then transition, isn't it? Because the change happens and you think that's what you're dealing with. But actually the transition lasts a lot longer, doesn't it? And I think that's not what we're prepared for necessarily in this kind of new way of working from midlife. Now, we should talk about the women in your book because they are pretty fabulous. They're very skilled in their fields. We've got a GP, a heart surgeon, and a trauma response doctor who's in and out of helicopters all the time. It's quite amazing. Very high powered roles. But we love that show Maternal. Did you see it on ITV?
Yeah, on your recommendation.
I mean, you really see how hard it is to be a mother, a working woman, or, you know, being recognised in the NHS. There's still a big gap, isn't there, between men and women in senior roles?
Yeah, I don't know any man who's ever been asked, how do you juggle it all? How do you manage having children and working as a consultant? I know lots and lots of women who've been asked that. Every woman, perhaps. And so, of course, that we've got some way to go, haven't we? I think that things are changing again. And like we always talk about, Gen Z are not having any of this. So there is a generation coming up who are going to, I think, change the whole zeitgeist of what being a woman means. And equality, and that's a really good thing. That can only be a good thing. It's still very gendered in terms of, I guess, how I get asked. I often, well, I'll go into meetings and people will ask me for coffee and I'll be the professor. And, you know, so that kind of thing often happens, and I doubt it ever happens for men. And so, yeah, we've just got so far. So much work still to do, I think, is how I put it.
Yeah, I'm on it. Now, something really wonderful happened to you. And I've seen you blossom with great joy at this because it's been a lovely story to tell. Huge change in your life as you fell in love. But you've just married a man that you first met when he was 3 years old at nursery. And he only came back into your life because he read The Language of Kindness, I think it was, wasn't it? And messaged you on social media. And you wrote a little bit about him in Quilt on Fire. But it's been such a roller coaster love story because you've been single since the age of 34, I think it was. So do you want to tell us what happened and fill us full of lovely romance now, Christy?
Yes.
Come on.
His name's Daniel. He's called Ben in the book, actually, because I disguised all the names. But he's given up on that now. So, and yeah, he slid into my DMs, is the truth. And I ignored him during the pandemic, early during the pandemic. He wrote me a long message. I'd gone back onto Facebook for some reason, which I'm off again now. And I think I was just so bored. I was communicating with anyone through any forum and receiving lots of images of pandas from my mum. I mean, that's how low things were. And then I had this very long message from Daniel saying we went to nursery school. My mum was his nursery teacher and we played together when we were three. Then we went to secondary school together and he was best friends with my brother in my brother's class. And do I remember him? And I thought, no, not at all. Don't have a clue. And I also thought, who is this weirdo? Maybe because I do get some weirdos. I'm sure you guys do as well. The DM weirdo stakes were high and I was thinking, oh, I'm not going to respond. But I phoned my mum and said, do you remember Daniel? And she said, well, yeah, you were like best friends when you were 3 and 4 years old. You both had white blonde hair and you played together all the time and you know his family and his brothers and he knows your family. And I was like, I don't remember this. I don't know if it was a mental block. But yeah, then I phoned my brother and he'd asked for help because he was doing a talk on kindness and that was what he was contacting me about. He said, I don't know if it was a ruse, probably. He claims not. He claims he was. But my brother said, you should help him if you can. He hasn't got a bad bone in his body. He's the nicest guy in the world. I can't believe you don't remember him. So I met him for coffee and we walked around Regent's Park because it was lockdown. So we were doing the whole Victorian courting for a long time. And I immediately knew him. And I knew him in my bones. It was so weird. And he was just family from day one. And I suppose having spent my whole life having relationships which were roller coasters, frankly, to just meet safe and calm and steady, I was really suspicious of it because I thought, what is this non-drama, lovely feeling of just being with a friend? This surely can't be what a relationship looks like. And it turns out that's exactly what a relationship should look like. And yeah, he's just absolutely wonderful. And he's got the biggest heart. He runs a food bank. He's just kind and calm and tolerates me, which is great. And yeah, we got married in June last year. And the mums, I can't tell you. I mean, my goodness, it's like if they had arranged my marriage and his, this would be it. So there were many, many, many tears. And yeah, it's been wonderful.
And he has three children, I think, doesn't he?
Two.
So you've integrated family now, haven't you? How has that worked out?
I've got a 31-year-old stepdaughter from my previous long relationship. She's 31 now. I can't believe it. And he has two sons who are similar age to my two. And so it's completely blended. It's completely mixed in terms of race and faith. And it's a kind of colourful, wonderful rainbow of chaos is how I would describe it. And it's lovely. And yeah, it's been challenging, but not anywhere near as challenging as I thought it would be because they all get on really, really well. And I think that's been a stroke of luck really for us. They all get on great.
A lot of women, on our Facebook group who are coming out of relationships in midlife or just don't want to be with their partner anymore. The idea of like starting again, how do you deal with your kids? All of that is, you know, they find that so daunting. Obviously, it's a bit running before you can walk. But what advice would you have for anybody thinking about dating again or worrying about how do I get my kids to accept this?
It's so individual, isn't it? Depends on your kids and it depends on your family circumstance and it depends on you. We took a long time to even tell anyone. We took 6 months before we introduced anyone or told anyone about it. We wanted to be quite sure that it was going to be a serious, serious thing. And I think we went very, very slowly. There was a time when we thought we'd just get married quickly and move everyone in. And then we thought, no, actually, let's take our time, wait till the older ones are off at uni, which we did. We did the softly, slowly approach. It worked for us, but it might be for someone else that it works to quickly pull the sticking plaster off. I think it depends on the age of the children because ours were a lot older and almost out the door anyway. We kind of thought it was reasonable to hang on. Yeah, I don't. And in terms of dating, I mean, I used to think, oh, you know, someone tall, someone with this job, someone ambitious, someone this. I don't think any of that now. I think choose someone kind. And if they're securely attached, even better.
Yeah,
that's my advice.
I think you might have to tell the the tarantula story?
I've got lots and lots of terrible dating stories, as have anyone, I think, who's been dating online as an older person. And one of the most bizarre, it wasn't even the most terrible, was a guy, and he seemed great. We were chatting a lot. We met for a drink that turned into dinner because it was, you know, he was fantastic. And we sat down for this dinner, at which point he pulled out a tarantula in a sort of glass box that you keep your makeup pads in. And he just said, oh, he comes with me everywhere. I don't know what I was thinking. I do not know what I was thinking, but I did not leave. I sat for three courses during this day and tried not to look at this giant spider. And I'm arachnophobic as well. I mean, it was just terrible. I don't know if he was doing it to make me awkward or to bring a bit of shock in. I'm not really sure of his motivation, but obviously politely declined to see him again for another day. He's not Daniel. I'll just put that out there in case everyone thinks Daniel's walking around with a tarantula in his back.
Oh, but listen, I'm sure you've got lots of exciting things happening on the book front. Anything you can tell us about, or what's coming up next for you? What are you focusing on?
Yeah, so I've got lots of exciting things happening. I've got a number of events coming up. I've got a big piece about the NHS coming out on Saturday, so 2 days in the Times, and then I'll be doing sort of face-to-face events, which is actually really exciting. And I'm Christy Watson Author on Instagram, and so I'll post all events up on there. And I'm just so thrilled to be meeting people in person to get to talk about books and writing and whatever anyone else wants to talk about. Dating, fine.
Are you writing something else?
I have just finished another book that I was writing with my daughter for a number of years, and that is going to be published in January 2025. And it is about generational differences. It will be right up your street, I'm sure. And it is, we really get into it. Racism, class, mental health, self-harm, social media, the works, from both of our perspectives. And they say never work with children and animals. Well, I mean, my God, we are coming out. It's been really great for both of us. And I feel like we've got such a stronger relationship. But the idea of working with a 16 to 18 year old girl to develop a book, you know, what was I thinking? Anyway, it's coming. We've done it. And that's what's next.
And I think it's interesting when you talk about the mix of your family, because your first long term partner was Nigerian, was he not? Yeah. So your daughter is part Nigerian and part British, isn't she, in that way? So she has a unique experience and upbringing, hasn't she?
Yeah, it's interesting because my kids have got a different racial heritage to mine. And obviously I've got a load of white privilege in that sense. But I grew up very working class, and they're pretty middle class, to the extent that my daughter started crying when avocados were running out in the UK. So I remember thinking, what is this? So we've got very, very different perspectives. And hopefully in this age that we're living in, when everyone's shouting and disagreeing about everything, we can hopefully find some, if not common ground, then ways to argue respectfully. That's the idea anyway.
Yeah, I'd love the sound of that, because it's so surprising. So I sort of think of myself as a very sort of liberal, open-minded, well-read, and I get it wrong all the time. With my daughter.
Yeah, well, for example, my daughter, when she was born, I'd had this humanist naming ceremony for her that I thought was really progressive, but with an entirely pink theme. And she changed her name because it's too gendered and she doesn't believe in gender at all. So we are coming from completely different perspectives, and I'm not perhaps as liberal as I thought I was, is what's happened.
Now, we can't let you go without just maybe some words of advice, and you've mentioned it before, and we've actually done a bit of our book tour together, so we've talked a lot about this. You have just said at the beginning of this interview that this is, you are out the other side. You've been through the perimenopause, you've got married, everything is better and it feels better. What words of hope can you offer women going into this stormy time?
Unfortunately, you can't go round the fire, you have to walk through it. But the other side, I feel like I know myself perhaps better than I ever have in my life. I'm very excited about the future. I'm really happy in my own skin. And I just feel more content, such a rubbish word, isn't it? Because it doesn't express, I suppose, in a shouty, sexy way, but I just feel really content. And you know, I'm very happy to be mooching around a garden centre on a Sunday afternoon. I don't feel the need to be chaotic or wild or whatever I felt the need to do in previous decades. And it's a beautiful place, I think. And yeah, I knowing what I know now, would not have been so afraid, because I would know that actually once the period of roller coaster and feeling fairly unstable settles down a bit, and that can easily settle down, by the way, with HRT, it's beautiful. It is a second spring, like many people describe it as, and it's a really beautiful, wise phase of life. Hopefully I'm edging towards wisdom and humility, but there's so much humor as well. There's so much mischief for women our age, but in a really sophisticated, I think it's a sophisticated mischief, which I love. So we're surrounded by people with a very, very sharp sense of humour who've been through this fire, and it's a great thing.
Thank you so much, Christy. That was so helpful. Thank you very much for coming back on again. And no doubt we'll see you again when your book with your daughter comes out.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to see you both.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, well, that was lovely catching up with Christy again. And now we are at the very useful, knowledgeable, knitwishery bit of the show, how to win at midlife, because we're going to be chatting about something that may make a difference in your daily life, self-hypnosis. Before you roll your eyes, listeners, and wonder if we've gone too far down the woo-woo road, bear in mind this is something Lorraine tested on your behalf. You've got a very strong anti-waffle force field, haven't you?
I have, yes. I don't like it. I don't agree with it at all.
Okay, well, this is going to make it even more interesting, because you've been talking to US psychiatrist Dr. David Spiegel about the launch of the hypnopharmacy on the health app Reverie. So for context, dear listeners, Dr. Spiegel is chair of psychiatry at Stanford University of Medicine. Very clever. He's a very well-respected medic and researcher whose specialty is psycho-oncology, which is the neurobiology of therapeutic hypnosis. That's a sort of list of words I don't think I've ever said before. Anyway, his work explores the role of the sort of mind-brain-body connection, which we are always interested in specifically in cancer outcomes and in the management of other conditions. And he says his work is about reducing the reliance on medication for many illnesses, especially antidepressants. So, we were intrigued to hear about the Reverie app and his work, and you gave him a call, didn't you, all the way to sunny San Francisco?
Indeed, I did. He was a very friendly and smart man, because I wanted to talk about this sense of stress, low-level anxiety and overwhelm that so many women in midlife seem to feel. And we hear it again and again on the Facebook group. And we know that 2/3 of GPs in the UK prescribe antidepressants when they could be offering HRT. And that worries both of us. And it worries both of us that women's mental health is often not taken seriously in midlife, and that we kind of hand over control of it to the medical profession, you know, almost immediately, don't we? Because we don't really know what's going on. And perhaps there is something we could do ourselves. And this kind of idea of self-hypnosis helping with our symptoms, when we talk about things like sadness and low mood, confusion and fatigue, is really appealing, I think. It's about stopping the spiral, catching our mental health in a place where we can affect it positively. Now, some people may need antidepressants. We're not saying that. But there is a stage right at the beginning
which I learned from Dr. Spiegel, where we could perhaps stop ourselves spiralling into this place that really seems to affect us quite a lot in midlife.
Yeah, and so it sounds like this is another tool, because there are tools out there, but sometimes it's finding the right one for you that really kind of works for you. And of course, when we're talking about self-hypnosis, what we're talking about is it's a natural solution that puts you in control of your mind and body rather than handing it to a medical expert. I know Dr. Spiegel explains self-hypnosis as our brain switching frequency, doesn't he, between alpha and theta waves. And when we operate in this way, we access enhanced visualization and imagination, heightened learning and concentration. And all of that helps create new positive neural connections and pathways to help us address our challenges, change habits, elevate thinking, and promote desirable behaviors. And his research has shown that this process can treat and potentially cure mental and physical health problems, including anxiety, depression, stress, sleep, chronic pain, and addiction.
Well, that was what was fascinating about talking to him, because I thought self-hypnosis was sort of staring in the mirror and saying, I am happy, and all that kind of ridiculous woo-woo stuff. But it really isn't anything to do with imagining things. It's more about strengthening one part of the brain so it connects to another part of the brain, so it works in a different way and it controls your body. So you could strengthen the bit of the brain that reacts when you get very, very hot, and you can teach it to cool yourself down. You can teach the brain to tell the body you need to physically bring your temperature down. And that, he was explaining to me, and he's talked women through this, is really helpful when you have a hot flush. Hot flush is caused by a lack of estrogen. We absolutely know the estrogen needs to be replaced for sure. But when you get hot flushes and you keep having them, you get really, really anxious. So the brain starts an alarm bell immediately and it spirals you quite quickly to fear, worry, anxiety. And then that bodily, that obviously stress really affects a hot flush, makes it much, much worse. If you can stop, the brain can stop the alarm bell going off, you can work on really simple things like visualizing yourself being in a cold bucket of ice. That will immediately tell the body, cool down. You don't need to go with this rising temperature. So it's really fascinating. So it's physiological self-hypnosis. It's not psychological. It's about neurology and it's about the brain. He says we've got this £3 supercomputer as an organ in our heads, but it doesn't come with a user manual.
So true.
So we have to learn how it works. And one of the ways of learning how it works is testing it through self-hypnosis, which I found absolutely fascinating.
There's a lot of background there, a lot of science, which I think makes complete sense. But what did Dr. Spiegel tell you about women in midlife specifically, Lorraine?
Well, I mean, I talked about the hot flushes, but also he talked about midlife being such a stage of transition, which is stressful, does cause anxiety, and the body reacts to that. So what he said, which I think is different from what we've heard before, is you start with the body and the internal things, not with the external things. So you don't start with what's making me stressful, what's happening around me, shall I remove myself from all that situation? You start with how does my body feel? So that puts you completely in control. Self-hypnosis is often seen as you being out of control, or hypnosis generally. It's not. It's about you being in control. So you start with the body. And he recommends this exercise that you can do every morning for 2 minutes when you wake up, lie in bed, and do a full body check-in. What hurts? What doesn't hurt? What feels great? What feels light? What feels heavy? Where do you need to ease some pain? Where do you feel tension? Where do you feel stress? And you go through that, and then you just talk to yourself in your mind, well, I'm going to help you with that today. Brain is going to help body with that today. You're almost telling your brain to start finding the bits, lighting up the bits of it that need to work to help with, you know, your hip pain, for example, Trish. And those signals then get stronger and stronger between the bits of the brain that control that. And if you do that regularly, you are minimizing your reaction to the pain. So it doesn't feel as painful, which I think is, you know, for our general day-to-day stuff, it's really, really helpful. And it's really helpful if you're going through transitions to see how your body changes every day, because there's so much going on in midlife. Your body is changing every day, and not just physical, but all the stress and the tension, which I found fascinating. So I'm going to do that 2 minute thing every morning.
Okay. What about things like rage, the midlife rage?
Well, I really wanted to ask about that. And I thought he's going to look at me like I'm mad. He's an American. They don't really study HRT in the same way, or menopausal hormone therapy, as they call it, MHT. didn't bat an eyelid. He said, oh gosh, yeah, absolutely. I see a lot of women who are going through this. He says he sees it all the time. But rage is a reaction, and you can be proactive about controlling your reaction. He taught me something called cyclical sighing, and you can do it for as long as you need. And the whole point of this is that breathing out is more important than breathing in. So when people say you're under stress, you're furious, take a deep breath, that's not really relevant. What is activating the nervous system is you breathing out, not breathing in. So cyclical sighing is when you breathe halfway through your nostril, take a pause, breathe the rest of the air in through your nostril, and then do a really long breath out. And you just keep repeating that. And that is your brain learns that the moment you start that, it's got to tell the nervous system to calm down.
I just did that while you were talking it through. It was really nice. You're right. It's that focusing on the sort of slow exhalation is really nice. Okay, so which brings me to, you know, I like meditation. I get into it. I assume that's a little bit like hypnotism maybe, because you're just doing stuff in your brain. But some people don't get on with this kind of thing. Does it work for everybody? Do you have to have a particular sort of mindset to be able to do it?
Wow, Trish. So this is the crux of everything. He can quote tons and tons of research over the years where women have been in excruciating pain, and he's taken them from a 10 out of 10 to a 3 out of 10 just by self-hypnosis. So you would think, wouldn't you, well, why don't we all do this? Why isn't the medical profession teaching us this? The complication is we really vary in who can be hypnotized and who can't. So that, you know, it requires a lot of patience to self-hypnotize if it doesn't come naturally. Now, the reason it won't come naturally is not attitude, it's your biology.
Right.
So it's how your particular brain works. There is some genetics, he was explaining in a very sciencey way about how some brains are genetically programmed to react differently to dopamine, etc. So it's just really varied. So it's really interesting. He said that 20% of people are very easy to hypnotize. They are the poets. So you fill in a little test when you do the app on what happens in certain situations. And I filled it in, and I can watch a film and, you know, several bombs could explode around me. But if I'm engrossed in the film, I won't notice any of that kind of thing. So I'm in the 20%, the poets, that would be. My brain is quite easily hypnotized, as we should find out. But around 60 people are what they call the diplomats. They're in that kind of mid-range. They've just got to relax a little bit more. They've got to let that bit of the brain spark up. They've probably got to practice self-hypnosis. And then there's 20% they call the researchers, who are sort of more those nerdy types who need an awful lot of fact for anything to happen. They're quite easily distracted. But you can learn it. So you teach your brain to do it. It starts with simple things like that 2-minute thing in bed in the morning. It just might take those people a little bit longer. Women and men, just the same of being hypnotized. It's the only time the genders are completely equal.
Okay. So what about the kind of, you know, because obviously there's a whole melee of stuff going on. You know, there's anxiety, that, you know, this whole overwhelm that we talk about, that women tell us about so much, that we've certainly have. Hormones, I mean, all of this must come into play. I mean, can you really sort of calm it all down? There's so much going on in life, isn't there? So how does that help?
Yes, there's always the caveat. There are some people that really will need therapy, psychotherapy, antidepressants, and HRT. That will be the beginning of the journey. But what he says he sees is that we can get into this, particularly in midlife, because transition and change is very difficult for all of us to deal with. Slightly elevated arousal feedback loop. So you worry, the body tenses, sets off the alarm in the brain. The brain says, body, you need to tense, something is going to happen. It's the fight or flight thing. Anxiety kicks in. So if you start with the body, how am I feeling? Not what's going on around me that's making me depressed, low mood, all of that kind of thing. How is my body feeling? And I think what was really interesting about this is he said, and he's looked at this with studies around motherhood and mothers, if your child is very distressed and anxious, or if you can just see your child's body changing because they're unhappy in some situation, your automatic response as a mum will be to touch them and to soothe them and to pull them close and to be calm. And not, women don't do that to themselves.
Yes.
They get cross with themselves. So we have an inbuilt system. We know neurologically soothes something that's very unhappy or upset, because we do that as a maternal instinct. And men do it too. Anyone soothes a child. What we need to do is turn the brain alarm down. So we need to get into practice by soothing ourselves, into practice with that breathing. And then when the alarm goes off, it won't be so loud next time.
So here's a question for you, what I'm quite interested in. Did you try the app before you spoke to him, or did you speak to him and then try the app? Because this all makes an awful lot of sense, and it's really useful hearing all the context. So I would imagine that will help me understand what's going to happen on the app more easily. So what does happen on the app?
Well, so I did sort of go into this in a very cynical, yeah, this is all very well, but if you can't focus, you can't focus. And obviously I'm often easily distracted in many ways sometimes, but I spoke to him and then I did the app, but I don't think would have made any difference, because when you self-hypnotize, it's, for me, it was so instant.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is the weird thing. So you go into the app, you pick what you want to do. I picked how to be less stressed in situations. You can pick anything between a 4-minute exercise and a sort of 16, 17 minute exercise. I picked a 5-minute exercise. He counts you in, it's his voice, and it's voice reactive. So you turn that on, you can say yes and no. He asks you on a scale of 1 to 10 where you are in terms of whether you feel relaxed or not. You count 3, 2, 1. So 1, you look up, 2, you close your eyes, 3, you breathe out. And at that point, if you're hypnotized, your arm, whichever arm's your dominant arm, will raise up in the air.
What? You just lie there and you're going 3, 2, 1, and then your arm goes in the air?
You don't. I was sat at my desk and your arm goes up in the air. So I had my eyes closed.
Oh.
And then during the exercise to relax, he was talking about splitting the screen. So what makes me stressed on one side, and on the other side, the one thing I can think about in my head with my eyes closed that might relieve that stress, or how I might feel better when I'm feeling that stress. So I went through all of that. Then you do a cyclical sighing, and then a little bit of breathing. And then he says, I'm going to count you back down, and then you're going to put your hand on the table, clench your fist and unclench it, and the hypnotism is finished. I didn't think my hand was up in the air.
Oh, okay, right.
And then I felt the table hit my hand, and I thought, what the hell's that?
Wow, that's amazing.
My hand had been up the whole time. Hadn't felt it go up, hadn't felt it up in the air. Wasn't achy. It was really odd. It was really, really odd.
Yeah.
So I know it worked, because I then did a couple of other exercises, and the following morning I did one, and the kids were banging around outside and I couldn't quite feel, and my hand didn't go, nothing happened. So I stopped halfway through because I thought, I haven't been hypnotized. So you know immediately.
If you have or haven't, yeah.
It was extraordinary.
Oh, I like it. So I can see how that is reaching parts of your brain, really, that you maybe aren't aware of, and it's training those parts. How much is this going to cost me if I want to give it a go?
Well, young Trish, it's £7.50 a month on this app,
okay.
The Reverie app, or around £89 a year. You get it all. And there are so many different things. There is how to get into the right mindset for exercise, how to get into the right mindset for an exam, how to get in the right mindset for sleep. So you can pick your journey, you can record it, and you can interact with the community if you want. As I say, it's voice activated. You say yes and no. So you don't have to use the voice thing, but you can. And you record how you feel after everything. So it sort of gives you a kind of breakdown of what you're going through as well. And I had a friend who tried it for sleep, who was really, really impressed, she'd been doing it 2 weeks. And then she'd had her first right the way through the night. She'd had cancer treatment and she'd had her first right the way through the night till 7 a.m. after doing it. So it is a real learning curve.
Yeah. So it could be for £7.50, it could be something that really works for you.
Yeah.
But you'll know fairly soon. So it's just a small investment, isn't it, to try and work out whether this is your thing. I like that. Well done.
And I think what you're looking for is self-hypnosis. So you're taking control and it's about your body rather than things that are helping you meditate or calm down, that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's also got stuff in it for, to stop smoking.
Yeah.
Things like that. It's obviously going to be quite effective for me. So that's the caveat. I obviously respond quite well to it. It might be more difficult for others.
Yeah, but people can give it a go. So that is the Reverie app for the note takers listening to the podcast, Reverie. So yeah, if you give it a go, do let us know what you think.
Right, it's time to say goodbye, but not before we go back in time and do a bit of a nostalgia noodle. And our guest Christy was talking about WhatsApps this week, and I'm off on a little trip to Francais, Trish.
Lovely. Very nice.
Waiting for some of your special French learning.
Franglais. Yes.
Yeah, Franglais to come in there. Anyway, so we were talking on the WhatsApp, what shall we take? Because we're going to a friend who's got a house there, but it's quite rural and therefore a little bit cold, and they bought it a million years ago and it didn't have a roof, so it's constantly being updated, and it's very lovely, but it's not your modern swishiness.
Is it Escape to the Chateau? Are you going to be filming an episode?
It's not. It's more rural than that, Trisha, I would say.
Oh, okay. More rural and run down, yeah.
One of the ladies coming said, well, what should we wear? And we all said, warm, you've got to stay warm, you've got to stay warm. And she said, are we thinking French exchange circa 1983.
Oh, okay.
And we said, yes, jumpers, because I don't know if you went on a French exchange.
Didn't. That's why my French is so bad. Did you go on one?
Yes. Can you imagine? My Cornish comprehensive was in the French exchange program. I think most kids did. I was in a very rural area, so they matched us up with a very rural area, and we would wear big woolly jumpers, hand-knitted jumpers. We were told to take everything warm.
Oh.
Now, unfortunately for my French exchange partner, she was from a very wealthy family who had an apartment in the city. So while all my friends went to the middle of nowhere in France and their lovely exchange girls came back to the middle of nowhere in Cornwall, I went to this rather bijou swish apartment. And also, you can imagine what was going through my mind. Ah, she will have to come back in 1983 to our tiny little bungalow on the edge of the moors. It's very lovely, but, you know, a small bungalow on the edge of the moors. At that point, my parents were going through their chicken rescuing phase. They were always rescuing animals from all over the place. The house was full of animals. And they were just roaming for it. She'd never seen a live chicken when she came back. And we have one in the kitchen. And so I felt quite sorry for her, but she did go quite French on us, Trish. She refused to eat any of the food. She wouldn't go in the bathroom because it didn't have a bidet.
Oh.
We had to swap her with someone more suitable.
Oh, you had to swap?
Yeah, she just was really unhappy in the countryside.
Oh,
she didn't want to go outside. She wouldn't put wellies on. I felt very sorry for her. I loved going to a bijou apartment. That was very nice.
But you did. Was she wearing a jumper then? Because I mean, I've missed out on a key Gen X milestone because I didn't do my French exchange. I don't know what you're talking about.
Big, woolly, fisherman-type jumpers that were the mainstay of the French exchange.
Right,
they would come over wearing those.
Yeah. Well, if anybody has got any exchange stories, we'd love to hear them. We haven't delved too deep on that one before, have we? So, yes, pop those on the Facebook group. You know where to find us, Instagram, email, hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. And we will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.